Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. What do you think are the biggest solvable problems facing humanity? Justice and inequality? Violence and war? Climate change and pollution? Well, today we're going to focus on one that I believe underlies all of those, population. The last book from today's guest, Alan Weisman, was thought-provoking, award-winning, and best-selling. The World Without Us, which was made into a powerful documentary, imagined what would happen to planet Earth if humans disappeared. Our massive infrastructure would collapse and vanish without human presence, but nature would swiftly begin to heal without our daily pressures. But Weisman would rather imagine a successful world with us, and that led to his newest book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. An award-winning journalist, Alan Weisman's reports have appeared in Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, Atlantic, Discover, Vanity Fair, Mother Jones, and Orion. A former contributing editor to the LA Times Magazine, he's a senior radio producer for Homelands Productions, and his books include Gaviotas, A Village to Reinvent the World, the best-selling and award-winning The World Without Us, and his latest, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, and that title, that subtitle, ends with a question mark. Welcome, Alan Weisman, to Free Forum.
Oh, thanks. Great to be with you.
So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. Can you tell us, in your own words, a bit about your path to the work that you do today? Feeling free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. Not necessarily this book or this book tour, but kind of what you think you're taking on.
Well, let's see. When I was a kid, I grew up outside of Minneapolis, what today we elegantly term as a wetland. We called it the swamp. But it was filled with wildlife, particularly a lot of birds, and I grew up believing that I was going to be a scientist because I was just enthralled by all those creatures. And then, let's see, I got into junior high, and there was the science teacher who did not like me, and there was the English teacher who liked me a lot, and, you know, those are sensitive years around puberty when rejection is tragic and encouragement is something that we cling to. So I kind of did a detour, and I ended up eventually becoming a writer. But the science love never really left me, and I found that though I've written about all kinds of things, you know, all over the world, that I was always happiest when I was accompanying scientists and getting to live vicariously their lives, going into a field with them for their research, and just getting to, once again, see all those things that I used to love as a kid. But more and more, as I did it, I began to understand that the nature that I so loved and took for granted as a child was coming under threat. And it was coming under threat for my own species. We were becoming so big, so powerful, that we were starting to push other things literally off the edge of the planet. And, you know, we can talk about this in more detail, but my last book inadvertently led me to understand that it was not just more powerful, it wasn't our prowess and our technology, but it was also our sheer numbers. And the current book that we're going to be talking about is my attempt to figure out, is there anything we can do about that?
Very good. Alan Weisman, let me ask you just a bit more about the previous book, The World Without Us. How did that book happen?
Well, I had covered all kinds of environmental disasters in various parts of the planet. I did a lot of them for magazines. I went to Chernobyl for Harper's. I went to Antarctica and the Ozone Hole for the LA Times Magazine. I was in burning rainforests for several different publications and also for radio documentaries that I was doing. And the more and more I started seeing things, you know, I was in the Arctic and looking at melting permafrost, I began to realize that I had kind of the privilege of being able to witness so many of the things going on the globe up close. But also, because I was seeing them myself, I began to realize that these were not discrete events. They were all connected to one another. So I decided that I had a responsibility, given this opportunity I'd have, to write a book about all this stuff, to put it all together. And it had to be a book because the global environmental crisis is too complex for just a mere article. But the problem with environmental books about environmental crisis is that most people just don't want to read them, except for people who already understand this stuff. It kind of reinforces, you know, that what they believe to be true. Most people just find that it's too depressing or too scary. And, you know, and who wants to pick up a book in their leisure time, their precious leisure time, you know, that talks about, oh my God, you know, maybe we're all going to die if we don't change what we're doing. So I thought for a few years, you know, how to deal with this until just the chance suggestion that somebody gave to me about something kind of different, I realized that, maybe the way to get around that fear was, you know, are we all going to die? It's just kill everybody off right in the beginning. We don't have to worry about that anymore. But, you know, through the magic of fiction, we get to see, you know, what happens next. And then it turns out that what happens next is rather remarkable. And I did, you know, it's a work of nonfiction. In just one paragraph in the beginning, I give a couple of possible, plausible ways that we could all disappear all at once. But they're possible enough that it's not science fiction, because a lot of people won't read science fiction, but remote enough that nobody was scared off like that, you know. For example, AIDS was going to go airborne and we'd all, you know, catch it tomorrow. And this stuff was really a remote possibility. So people kind of relaxed in and enjoyed the book. And of course, the first thing you see when humans disappear is everything we leave behind, which is, without calling it that, it's another way of, you know, explaining what our environmental impact is, all the stuff that we have done on the planet. But then it turns out that nature makes swift work of all that, and nature can restore itself, and nature can heal and even fill empty niches, you know, from where, you know, the formerly inhabited by species that we extinguished. And my hope, ultimately, when people saw how, when relieved of our daily pressures, the world could spring back, was to ask themselves, wow, isn't there some way that we can add ourselves back into that picture, only in some kind of harmonious relationship with the rest of the planet and not in the, you know, the hand-to-hand combat that we seem to be locked in with the rest of nature right now. But as I, you know, as I wrote the epilogue of that book, kind of trying to sum up, you know, and leave that on the table, I decided to look at, well, is there a way to quantify what it is that we are doing right now that is so overwhelming on the planet? And I'd interviewed this guy from something called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, who believed that, you know, humanity was a good idea for a while, but clearly we're just screwing the place up right now. And the most ethical thing that we could do is just admit that it's no longer working, and rather than drag all these other species down with us as we go down agonizingly, we should just stop procreating right now. And, you know, and he said, you know, just think, every decade, as there were fewer and fewer people, the world would become wilder and more natural. The last people on the planet would see the Garden of Eden restored, and then it'd be over. We'd hand it off to some other species to deal with. Well, again, you know, that really clarified for me that I was writing this book because I do want a world with us.
Right.
But it made me look for a compromise between what he was suggesting and what we are doing. And it turns out that, well, first I see these big population numbers that boggle us all. We really can't wrap our heads around them. So I just did some simple long division, dividing by 365, and I discovered that every 4 to 4.5 days, we're adding 1 million people to the planet. Now, that's a number that we can all kind of grasp, and it doesn't sound sustainable to anybody. So I left that question hanging at the end of the world. Oh, is there any way that we could keep doing that? you know, what would happen if we tried something like the Chinese did, you know, setting all the social considerations aside of the one-child policy. And, you know, that would bring us back to our 1900 population of just 10.6 billion, which, and that was before, due to reasons that I'm sure you and I will be discussing here, our population doubled and then doubled again in the 20th century. Completely unprecedented, not only in human history, but probably in any other organism's history, that suddenly our curve shot straight up. You know, should we be thinking about doing something like that to bring ourselves back into a safe, sustainable, you know, relationship with our planet? So many people, turns out, wanted to talk about that, and I got much less blowback than I expected. I was even on Catholic radio programs and Southern Baptist radio programs where they were interested in it. But recognizing that population is a very loaded question, because I started reading about it and I found out that it's just terribly polarizing, because it's such an emotional experience for most of us. You know, and frankly, you know, instinctively, look, we're organisms. We're designed to make copies of ourselves, just like any other organism, you know, to keep our lineage going and keep our, even our cultural heritage going. And like any other organism, we used to make extra copies of ourselves because nature, you know, a lot of them wouldn't survive to adulthood. Well, now in the last 200 years, because of medical technology and other things like food technology, many more of us survive. We don't die. Our infant mortality is quite low, and that's why we have these huge numbers. But still, the idea of controlling those numbers makes us all very uncomfortable. I decided as a journalist I should look at this as objectively as possible, using the tools of journalism to see if I could cut through all the emotion and all the politics and religion about it and see, is there a way that we can figure out what we should do, and then is there a way that we can then do something about it?
Right, right. And you're leaping ahead into some of my future questions. One thing I want to say right away is this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. The other voice is Alan Weissman, author a few years ago of the bestseller The World Without Us, and we're talking about his new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And to learn more, you can go to the publisher's website, Little Brown, one word, littlebrown.com/countdown. One thing I want to say about the previous book is that I was interested to hear you describe how it evolved before it began being written. In other words, that there was a missing link, how to approach that question. And I thought I have often heard from those people you described as those who already understand it, right, the environmentalists, who will often say, you know, it's not about saving the planet. The planet's going to be fine. It's about saving us and our children and so on. But what you did was took that, which I've heard many times, and made it vivid and powerful and something you could actually walk around in, which would then reach those who didn't know that was so as well as those who did. So my congratulations for finding that thing to unlock the question.
Well, thank you very much. And frankly, I concur with those other people, because it turns out the planet will be fine.
That's right.
The planet has gone through horrendous, you know, extinctions and mass destruction before. You know, the Permian extinction wiped out 90% of everything alive, and it took millions of years, but then, you know, some weeds laid down a little bit of biological material that eventually formed soil, and some creatures clung to it and started to proliferate, and you know, there was only one vertebrate left on Earth, a toothed worm, our ancestor. But eventually that ancestor evolved into all these different creatures that, you know, eventually became us. So the world will do just fine. You know, it will eventually cover up all of our messes when we go. Because
right.
We will. Every species eventually goes extinct, just like every person eventually dies. But I'm not ready for my species to go extinct.
That's right.
I like being a human being. So what I am really concerned with is not just the world, but the world that allowed us to evolve and to flourish, and to see if there's a way that we can continue to do so.
Very good. Now, I'm not going to ask you right now what those four questions are, that expert told you were the most important and the hardest. But I'm going to tell you that occasionally on this show, I ask three big questions under which all the other questions fall, and I call it, it's broke, let's fix it. So if the issue is population, the three questions are, how do we know population is broken? What's the evidence? So I'll give you an opportunity to just give us some of those highlights that make it really clear. And then, how did it get broken? What's the history? And you already did some of that, which says basically that, you know, we evolved to copy ourselves, and now we reached a point where we were copying more than we needed to and suddenly hit that enormous jump that you described. And then the third question is, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? So the just again, this is just to give the highlights so somebody gets it fast. How do we know population is broken? What's the evidence, Alan Weissman?
Well, a couple of things. We, first of all, are now consuming an enormous amount of concentrated energy in order to run civilization as it has evolved. And I think that what we do is very natural. A lot of people think that humanity is in, you know, civilization is something in nature or something else. But, you know, we're not the only creatures that have technology. Beavers make dams, birds build nests, you know, elephants reshape forests to their liking. And, you know, we're just very adept at technology. But we are fueling it now on stuff that nature, you know, had a surplus of, so it kind of buried it safely away. And we dug up in the last 250 years or so millions and millions and millions of years worth of this pent-up concentrated energy that nature wasn't doing anything with. And we burned it all at once and shot it skyward. And now our atmosphere is, I mean, we can think of it as being overfilled with insulation. So it's holding much more heat in. And that heat's got to go somewhere, so the ocean is absorbing it, and the ocean is expanding, and it, you know, and it's rising. And as it dissolves in the ocean, it eventually, if it keeps going this way, it's going to turn it into carbonic acid. I mean, you know, think of salty Perrier water. But as it marches in the acidic direction of the pH scale, it's changing the chemistry a great deal. Now, you know, people can say, well, you know, if we all stopped consuming, if we went immediately to zero emission energy, then we wouldn't be doing that and there wouldn't be a problem anymore. But there would be a problem, because even if all of us who are pumping all that carbon out our tailpipes or up our chimneys, suddenly we're putting, you know, some sort of clean energy out there, which may defy certain laws of thermodynamics. But, you know, let's just suppose. Still, our presence on this planet is also taking its toll just by surely being here. We need materials to shelter ourselves. We need land to live on. And we particularly need land to produce our food. 40% of the planet right now is devoted to either cultivating or grazing what we eat. And, you know, if we're usurping 40% of the non-frozen terrestrial planet right now, that doesn't leave an awful lot for an awful lot of other species. We're just one species. The relationship between those us and those other species is very, very significant. I mean, we know, and ecologists and conservation biologists can explain to us in great detail why everything that we do is ultimately possible to us, because we have other species that are pollinating things that we eat, that are keeping the atmospheric chemistry breathable for us, that are eating the insects that might otherwise infect us with diseases that we don't like, that are holding the water in our soil so things don't flood, or so we don't dry up in drought. I mean, there are numerous things that happen in the ecosystem that we depend on. Even those, you know, of us who live in cities that seem very artificial, I mean, ultimately, we are all dependent on those same things. People in cities do not eat food made out of concrete. You know, they eat food that's being grown somewhere. And we're just overbalancing the thing. because we're extinguishing more and more of those species right now with the space and the stuff that we are demanding from this planet. So it's just starting not to work, and it's starting to backfire on us. I'll give you one more example.
Sure.
One of the things that we have done to be able to stretch our food supply, to keep feeding so many of us, is we invented artificial nitrogen fertilizer that took place just before World War I. And before it happened, we could never have reached the numbers that we are today, because plant life, the sheer plant biomass on the planet, was limited by the relatively few nitrogen-fixing plants out there. It's actually the bacteria in their roots that can pull nitrogen out of the air and contribute it to the soil. It's one of the main building blocks for plant life. And plant life, of course, is what we eat, or other things eat it, and then we eat those other things. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer, our way of pulling the nitrogen out ourselves and chemically spreading it across soil, completely blew the lid off of what nature could do. Let me just put it this way. Without it, 40% of us would not be here. Our population would be less, about a little more than half of what we were if we weren't using artificial nitrogen fertilizer. And, of course, everybody knows that there's a price that we pay for that. To make this stuff takes a lot of fossil fuels, both as its feedstock and the energy in creating it. And then when it degrades, it releases nitrous oxide, which after methane is our third most potent greenhouse gas. And it goes downstream. It messes up our water systems. It reaches the oceans. It leaves chunks the size of New Jersey in the oceans dead of any life. And it sterilizes soil. And it's also connected probably to a lot of the environmental diseases that we're now starting to suffer. So we found some ways to stretch the habitat in order to accommodate more of us, but it's coming back to bite us.
Right, and the other one that goes along with that, I'm sure you'll agree with me, Alan, is so we've, in some sense, overworked the soil to produce this plenty. And that is not sustainable. The other one is we have overworked our aquifers and are doing so now, which means that the water that we are using right now with those fertilizers to produce this plenty is not there forever. And when those two, so we've got a solution that created this, as I say, plenty or this enormous population, but both of them are moving in the other direction at this point. Agreed?
Yeah, and so can I give a little background to that whole aquifer comment of yours? You know, a lot of people, particularly economists, will say that, look, back in the 1970s, Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, were saying that we were going to have these huge famines. We couldn't keep growing the way we were going, because our numbers were going to overwhelm food production. And, of course, they were echoing what Robert Thomas Malthus, an economist, said back in 1798, before there were even a billion people on the planet. He predicted that. And they said, but that didn't come to pass because of the Green Revolution. It was a technological miracle. We created these wonderful breeds of plants, by crossbreeding them, that produce much more food per stalk, and they completely eliminated the famines that were predicted. And of course, it was tried out in India and in Pakistan first, and lo and behold, they did not they did not succumb to famine. But what has happened there? Well, India today is going to surpass China as the most populous country. And I'm going to leave Pakistan for a little later in this.
Yes, we'll definitely get to Pakistan.
Conversation, but it's one of the fastest growing nations on earth. But in India, where it's one of the 21 countries I went to research this book, Countdown, one of the first people that I interviewed there was the guy who helped implement the Green Revolution in India. And he is now the head of the Punjab Farm Bureau. And he told me that, the three biggest problems in India now are population, population, and population. Because when the Green Revolution occurred, all these people didn't die. so they live to beget more children, and that's why the population is so huge. But to keep the Green Revolution going, you got to pump that aquifer. He said, in the beginning, you know, we dug wells because that was the fastest thing to do, and they went down about 50, 75 feet. He says, but then the water table started dropping 250 feet. And then when it got to 500, things started getting really critical. And now it's down below 1,000 in many places in Punjab, which is their breadbasket. And, I mean, this is a very sobering story. I spent a day after I met with him going around with farmers he introduced me to, interviewing widows of farmers in India whose husbands simply ran out of money to keep digging those wells deeper and deeper and deeper and finally committed suicide. Since 1995, 270,000 Indian Green Revolution farmers have committed suicide. And the symbolic method of choice is by drinking pesticide.
Oh, my God.
Really tragic.
It's interesting, Alan. I knew the suicide was an issue, right? But the number you just said just stopped me in my tracks.
I corroborated it with the Indian government.
Since 95, so we're talking 18 years, over 500,000 suicides from farmers.
No, not over 500,000, 270,000, over a quarter million.
Over a quarter million, that's what I meant. I mean, just it's phenomenal. That's the voice of Alan Weissman. I'm Terrence McNally. You're listening to Freeform. Alan wrote a huge bestseller a few years ago, The World Without Us. And we're talking about his new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for Future on Earth, which basically says, how can a world work with us? And takes on the question of population. And you can learn more at littlebrown.com/countdown. So I think you basically answered those first two questions. How do we know population is broken? You know, look around. It's showing up in all, you know, one, you could do just numbers of how many new births every year in this country or that country and so on. But basically, you took it further than that and said, so it ends up leading to this result and this result and this result. How did it get broken? We basically talked about the history there, and very much of it has to do with the Green Revolution and technology and so on. But how do we fix it? We're obviously going to spend, we've got another half an hour here. We're going to spend time going into the specifics of all of this. But what is the solution?
Well, the solution is, fortunately, I mean, this is one environmental question that we've got the technology to deal with. You know, we don't have to invent some new, super new, zero emission forms of energy that, and then figure out how to get the world to implement them. This is something that many people in the world are already doing, and many more want to do it if they have access to it, and that is simply to use contraception. And in Countdown, by the way, I do talk about the new forms of male contraceptions that are coming online. A lot of them are much simpler than female contraception. There are several kinds of reversible vasectomy, and it's not only available to us, but it would be downright cheap. The United Nations Population Fund and several institutes, I won't give all the names, but several of them are cited in my book. And by the way, this book's got about 100-page bibliography. I did an awful lot of research for this besides going to 21 countries.
Well, the hotter the subject, the more controversial the subject you take on, the more you need the notes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had to anticipate all the arguments and be able to respond to them or be proven, be proven wrong. And, I was testing my hypothesis. Again, I approach this as a journalist, not as an activist. The cost for providing contraception to everyone who wants it, and I stress want because we really have to talk about how this does not have to be coercive. I don't believe in governments telling us what we should do. And I've got several examples in my book about voluntary programs nationwide, and it's several different kinds that have brought the population down to below replacement rate, meaning two people replace themselves with two kids. In fact, in one case, faster than China's one-child policy. But to make that contraception out there available so people could choose to use it as, you know, and decide what number of children that they want, would cost less per year than the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past decade. we're talking about something just slightly over $8 billion, and that is eminently affordable in today's world.
I just want to bring up, and you've kind of inferred them already, but two of the questions that others might ask of you. In other words, if contraception is the solution, how do you get to that through men and through women? What's the approach that works?
Well, you know, obviously traditionally on the planet, there has been gender discrimination, and for, you know, reasons that sociologists and biologists argue and incessantly, males have had oftentimes a dominant role, and women have been treated more as property. And in every culture, in every history, in every religion, there's been a mandate to be fruitful and multiply. So that meant that the, you know, and the reason for that, of course, is so the religion or nation or tribe, whatever, can be the biggest and most powerful and therefore not get outcompeted by its neighbors. And the most powerful men oftentimes were the ones that had the biggest, you know, tribe of relatives around them. So, and this is in every culture. You know, look in, you know, Judeo-Christian culture, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were all polygamists for the same reason that the Mormons were later on. It was a strategy to have a lot of kids. You know, today we are the recipients of a history that fortunately is now finding finally turning the corner on all this. What I started to say before is that the best contraception of all turns out to be educating females. An educated woman who, as she's studying, you know, tends to defer her childbearing until later on, because she wants to get through school, and then once she's done, she's got something interesting and important and economically helpful for her family, which is very hard to do. Even if you want to be a mother, it's hard to do with seven kids, but it's, you know, it's possible to do if you have two or fewer. So that's what most high school graduates in the world who are female, on the average, they tend to have two children or fewer. Now, getting males to accept this sometimes is challenging. In some of the countries that I went to, they're still polygamists. Because it's their tradition. I went to Niger in French West Africa, and it's pretty awful there because they're so poor and the climate is changing on them that so many of their children are dying. They're just, the wives keep popping them out to just try to stay ahead of the Grim Reaper. And also, you know, they're in competition with other wives, you know, to be the one that's most fruitful. And that's a very difficult thing to turn around. But when I met with tribal leaders in many, many villages in Niger, they were starting to realize that that was their tradition for as long as they could remember. But in a world that they could always count on pretty much this 10-year drought cycle, and they were kind of geared to expect it. But now it's become a 5-year drought cycle and then a 3-year drought cycle. In fact, when I was there, the 3-year drought cycle had been going on for 3 years and it hadn't ended. And they were starting to realize that maybe this is a time that they have to do something different because they realize that they're part of the problem. In village after village, they would say to me, you know, if you'd been here 25 years ago, you couldn't have seen those houses over there because of all the trees we used to have. So what happened to the trees? Well, so many of us needed firewood. And now they just can't produce enough food or enough cattle to take care of everybody. There's not enough water for everyone. So they're starting to see that maybe this is a time that, you know, we have to refrain from embracing so much. In Judeo-Christian history, that happened in the fourth generation of the Israelites. Joseph realized that scarcity could set in. So he wasn't a polygamist like his forefathers. He only had one wife and two kids, and he counseled the Israelites and the Pharaoh of Egypt that in order to preserve themselves, they had to conserve.
You point out also that in Islam, that Muhammad also counseled, yes?
Yeah. He is very, very specific about every child being entitled to 2 years' worth of mother's milk, which means you don't want to get pregnant You want to space your births.
That's family planning, yeah. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Alan Weissman. You may remember his bestseller a few years ago, The World Without Us. Well, we're talking about his new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And you can learn more at littlebrown.com/countdown. Alan Weissman visited 21 countries looking at different countries, different cultures, different traditions, different religions. And one of his great it's not your great success story. It's their great success story. But so few of us know about it. It takes place in Iran. Tell us about that.
Well, Iran in 1979, had a theocratic revolution, and immediately thereafter, they were attacked by Saddam Hussein, who saw that centuries of dynastic rule suddenly were over, and Iran was kind of in an organizational shambles, and it was a perfect time to go in there and snatch an oil-rich province that is right on the border with Iraq. And of course, he tried to do the same thing a decade later in Kuwait. Well, the Iranians didn't have the sophisticated weaponry that Saddam Hussein had. And back then, he was NATO's ally. We all remember his meetings with Dick Cheney. And he had NATO even provide him with the feedstock for nerve gas. And the Iranians just had people. So the Ayatollah Khomeini asked every fertile woman in Iran to get pregnant for the good of the country and to help build a 20-million-man army to fight off the invading Iraqis. Well, for 8 years, they were able to hold off Iraq because they had this huge population growth. In fact, at one point, they were near the biological limits for females, probably the biggest population growth spurt in the history of humanity. But then when the war finally ended in a stalemate, the planning and budget director of Iran realized that they really had a problem, because within a decade or so, they were going to have to employ all these young men who were going to be the soldiers for the army, because they didn't know how long the war was going to go on. And he warned the Ayatollah that, a nation filled with young men who were underemployed and unemployed because their economy just wasn't going to be ready to receive this huge bubble of population, that was in danger of being a really destabilized country, because, young men get very frustrated. And he's sort of describing Pakistan today, which is another country I go to in this book. So the Ayatollah agreed that maybe they had to implement family planning, but they didn't want to do what China had done. There were many critiques about the Chinese one-child policy that had been going for 10 years at the time. So what they did in Iran was, first of all, they issued a fatwa saying that there's nothing in the Quran that says if you have a number of children that wisdom dictates you can responsibly care for, that you can't use any form of birth control, including an operation, vasectomy or tubal ligation, to keep your family at a sustainable size. Second, they made all of those things available throughout the country. I spoke to a very conservative Muslim OBGYN in Tehran, who described to me the horseback brigades that they used to take into these remote villages, bringing surgical tools and bringing condoms and injections and birth control pills. And then the only thing that was compulsory was premarital classes. Mm-hmm. They wanted every couple to know, among other things, how much does it cost to raise and feed and clothe and educate children? And women young couples got this right away. And then the most important thing, perhaps, is that they encouraged women to stay in school for the reasons that I mentioned otherwise. A woman with schooling isn't going to burden herself with too many kids, so she can't use that schooling for the benefit of herself, her family, and her society. And, you know, today 60% of university students in Iran are female, and they brought themselves down to replacement rate a year faster than China did.
That's a phenomenal story, and I think the one thing I love with people hearing that is that, one, you use the, I mean, you find the example and use it because it says, look, without coercion, a culture that we would think would have a great deal of trouble changing was able to change from, you know, from extreme on one end to one of the extreme success stories. I also like the fact that it makes Iranians living, breathing human beings rather than stereotypes at this point.
You know, I had a really wonderful time in Iran. I spent 2 weeks there. I couldn't get in on a journalist visa because we won't give journalist visas to Iranians. So I was able to finally get in as a tourist, and I took my wife with me so I would look like a tourist. But it turns out that I also wanted an extra set of eyes if I wasn't able to do any interviewing. But I was able to talk to whoever I wanted in Iran. And people were very, very frank with me about their concerns about their own government, the concerns, and this is one that we will all really understand here, that they say that when you mix up mosque and state, you know, for us it would be you blur the separation between church and state, you get into all kinds of trouble. There's all kinds of opportunities for corruption. And I interviewed many, many devout Muslims. They really are concerned about the downside of theocracy.
Very good. That's Alan Weissman. We're talking about his book, Countdown, a massive study around the world of population as a problem, and as we're talking about now, population with solutions. So let me just ask one question, which I have heard others ask you, which I know I'm sure has come up as you've been talking about this book. What you're saying is women should have less children, women should get an education, and I'm sure the question comes up, why are you a white affluent male telling poor women of color around the world what to do with their bodies?
I'm not telling them what to do with their bodies. I am suggesting that the opportunity be made available to them to decide for themselves what to do with their bodies. And women, it turns out, when given the opportunity to do that and also given the education to understand the implications of what they're doing, tend to make a decision that would be to the benefit of not just themselves, but the benefit of their planet and mine. So that's it. I mean, I completely understand why there has been great concern among women in the past over the population question, because some of the methods that have, and I talk about this in the book, they're all in there. You know, some of the methods that have been exercised to cut population have been brutal, and they attacked women first, you know, with forced sterilizations. And, you know, everybody talks about the forced sterilizations in India and in China, but you know, I'm sorry, that tradition began in the United States, and it began in a laboratory called Puerto Rico, where we, you know, they're second-class citizens anyhow because we don't allow them the full benefits of citizenship, even though they are citizens. And we use Puerto Rico. First of all, we went in there and started sterilizing women. I mean, today you say that the phrase la operación in Puerto Rico, and everybody knows what it means. It means getting your tubes tied. A third of the Puerto Rican women got their tubes tied, and many of them without knowing that that's why they were seeing the doctor. They were seeing the doctor for something else, and there was forced sterilization. And then we used them as guinea pigs to test out birth control pills. And the first birth control pills that we tested there had estrogen levels 100 times higher than what we have right now, and that's a true figure. And women died, and women got sick. You know, so yes, there have been brutal excesses against females in the past, and the idea of solving the world's environmental problems by keeping that responsibility on women to do something absolutely is going to enrage some women justifiably. But the excesses of the past are something that we have learned from. And some of the great family planning experts in this world and some of the admirable people who I accompanied in the field, you know, in Africa and in Asia and in the Americas, they're women. They get it. And the way they explain this to women is, you know, this next child that you may be expecting, is it going to fill you full of joy, or is it going to fill you full of worry because you won't know how to take care of him or her? And when those answers come up, then they offer them an opportunity to do something about it. And it's their choice. None of this is going to work happily if it's some government or some male telling somebody, some female, what to do.
The bottom line to what you're suggesting is education, opportunity, and choice.
Exactly.
And as you say, as you point out, and as I well agree, that's at least a win-win-win. People talk about how many people are not at this moment given a place at the table to contribute to solving the world's problems. Those women, once they become educated, become billions of people whose minds and whose genius, in addition to not having all those children, are going to be contributing to solving other problems that we face.
We need them. You oftentimes hear from economists who are very pro-growth, you know, they say we need bigger populations because, you know, there's so much human ingenuity that we will tap, and so if we have more children, we'll have, you know, more ingenuity. Well, look at all the human ingenuity we're wasting.
Exactly.
By not tapping all this female brain power that we have in the world.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, I want you to talk, Alan Weissman, about a couple of other countries. Mexico has also been successful. There's a country which we think of as Catholic, for one thing, as having, you know, what we see right now, the face we see in America very much might be a drug war and so on. But they've been very successful at this. How did they do it?
You know, Mexico, back in the 70s, had one of the highest population growth rates in the world. But, you know, they were getting pressure from the United States to do something about that. And, you know, it was a good thing that the United States did was, you know, until the Reagan years, we were promoting family planning programs in countries that were growing so fast that they could not take care of their own populations. They couldn't feed them or employ them. And so that was creating migration pressures in the United States. Now, I'm fortunate. I've lived in Mexico. I speak Spanish fluently. I love having Mexican neighbors in the United States. But there's no question that migration pressures always stress out society. So the implementation of family planning in Mexico was done in two ways. One, and I was a witness to this when it first happened, is that when they would bring birth control to all these little villages, they would also bring vaccinations. So women could bring their living children there, and they could get polio and DPT shots, and then they would know that there's an excellent chance that children wouldn't die in them, so they wouldn't keep having to have extra children. The other thing that was really kind of wonderful, and it can be traced to the vision of one man, a TV producer and writer named Miguel Sabido, was to use everybody's favorite form of entertainment, the telenovela, the soap opera, and to design a whole series of soap operas that talked about, you know, kind of subtly inserted the message that, oh, that family that's doing so well, they only have a couple of kids, and the family that's just, you know, at its wit's end has so many, they don't even know how to feed them all or take care of them all. And, you know, gradually they worked more and more of the overt message into the narrative. You know, a wife would finally tell her husband, I'm tired of popping out babies for you. I want to stop. And the husband, of course, would be some macho, and he would say, but, you know, this is, you have to do it because I'm the man. And then, of course, that kind of tension would get the readers all glued there. So maybe several episodes later, he'd finally see the light. And, you know, these kinds of things, you can track the drop in Mexican fertility along with those, you know, the programming of those soap operas. And, you know, I mentioned in my book that there are now soap operas available in many languages, you know, over 20, that are bringing this message to various parts of the world. And in Pakistan, I followed a street theater group that was performing in its 265th village. And it was basically the same kind of thing. But when you get to the real tense moment in the play, when, you know, they suddenly turn to the audience and they say, okay, what's the problem here? And all the women in the audience know exactly what the problem is. And then the actors reveal themselves actually to be a medical team. And they say the clinic is open and everybody lines up. It's just really, really lovely.
Yeah. So that's Alan Weissman. We're talking about the book Countdown. We got about 4 minutes here. I want to bring up the other side of this. Now, before I do that, let me just tell people, we've only scratched the surface of what's in the book. You can learn more about what happened in China. You can learn more about what's happening in the other direction, in Pakistan, in the Philippines. There's just an enormous amount of information, as I say, going back to how does this question and this solution deal with culture, religion, economics, etc. But I want to say the other side of this. I mean, one can make the case, obviously, that what really matters in terms of climate change, other environmental issues that population is a pressure on, is population times consumption. That is the carbon footprint that we have. And obviously, you know, we're talking in Los Angeles right now, huge carbon footprint. Rather than asking why not focus on reducing consumption, and I know your simple answer to that is that there is no condom for consumption, talk about Japan.
Well, Japan is a country that has a shrinking population now, because they had to cut off the baby boom at the end of World War II. They lost the war. They were starving. Their soldiers came home and impregnated their wives. The same thing, you know, the same as happened here. And they had a big population bubble. And suddenly, they were in such a dire situation that women were literally throwing themselves in front of trains. So in an emergency measure, they legalized abortion. This is before birth control pills. And millions of Japanese women partook of that rather than watch another baby die of hunger. So now, as the last overgrown generation dies off, it's being replaced by a much smaller generation, which succeedingly has had fewer children, and particularly since education is high in Japan, even fewer. So by the middle of the century, they're going to be approaching their World War II population once again. And many economists in Japan are terrified about that, because they think that, you know, you always have to have a growing population. You need, you know, more consumers for the products of capitalism. And also what they really are talking about is, you know, you need that they want a big labor force. And that's because the bigger the labor force, the cheaper the labor is. You know, you can get poor people competing against each other for whatever jobs are. Well, I met a very distinguished economist in Japan at a major policy institute who is much more realistic. He said, this is happening. Not only is it happening, but it's an opportunity for us to get real, to stop trying to be constantly expansive on a planet that doesn't grow, and in their case, on an archipelago that doesn't grow. He sees that transition is going to take place as the population drops off. They're going to go away from crowded cities with heavy export industries to lighter industries. Younger people, and I follow some of them in this book. And by the way, the book is not information, it's stories.
Right, right.
You
exactly.
Gather all this by following the people that I met.
And thank you for pointing
many
that
wonderful
out.
Stories. And I follow young people who are going back to the land because the land is becoming cheaper. You know, as all these old farmers die off, their houses that they can afford, and, you know, there's old wasabi farms that they can take over. And as this economist told me, industry's going to follow them, but it's going to be lighter industry, more nimble. It's going to be great for workers because wages will not drop because there'll be fewer workers.
Exactly.
But as demand drops, then working hours will also drop. And he says we're going to redefine prosperity in terms of having more leisure time. There'll be more breathing space in a less populous Japan, and people will start to really regain the pleasures of not just going to Disneyland, but going outside and having picnics and hiking. And he sees that over a few decades, as this transition takes place, it's going to be possible to do this and get people to accept it and get people to enjoy it more and more.
Very good. And when Alan and I spoke off the air, we talked about some of the trends that are happening with younger people in America as well. The shareable economy, the fact that kids in this country don't feel the urge or the need to get a car or buy a house. And so perhaps there's something that's happening in the culture. Japan, the U.S., my sense is it will spread, that not only meets our population issues but begins to meet our environmental issues. And as you said the other night when I saw you speak, a saner society, reduced consumption, a solid state economy, an economy with limits in a planet with limits. We've got to bring it to a close here. So again, the book is Countdown, our last best hope for a future on Earth. And as Alan pointed out, it is, he's a journalist. It is full of stories. It is stories as he tracks down the answers and what works and doesn't work in this and that country. It is stories, and you know how much I love that. To learn more, you can go to littlebrown.com/countdown. Thank you, Alan Weissman. Keep up the good work.
Pleasure to be on.
For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts, join me in pursuit of a world that just might work by going to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive weekly email announcements, tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, 4 or 5 articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at TEMCNALLY@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.